In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
The last time that we spoke with today's guest, he had just set in motion a chain of events that would end with a former Canadian Army reservist standing in a Maryland courtroom, facing charges for planning violent terror attacks.
For months after Patrick Matthews disappeared at the Manitoba border, he lived in the shadows until the FBI knocked down the door of the Delaware apartment he was renting. He was arrested along with two other alleged members of an aggressive neo-Nazi group called The Base.
What happened in those months between the exposure of Patrick Matthews as a white supremacist recruiting for The Base in Manitoba and his arrest had been a mystery until he was caught earlier this month. Following that arrest, the court released documents that detail what is alleged to have happened in the weeks and the months after Winnipeg Free Press reporter Ryan Thorpe went undercover and outed Matthews in the paper. It's a long and frightening trail that lays bare how these groups lurk in the shadows, hide one another from the police, and plan deadly attacks. And it offers a picture of the efforts that law enforcement is making to track them as they do that. And finally, it shows us how a Canadian neo-Nazi fled the law, remained on the run, and vowed vengeance on the man he blamed for all of it. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Ryan Thorpe is the Winnipeg Free Press reporter who outed Matthews, who broke this story, and who has continued to follow it. Hello, Ryan.
Hey.
First of all, you are in the documents in court. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that definitely caught me off guard a little bit. After news broke that Patrick Matthews had been arrested in the United States, all of these court documents started being released to the public, quite detailed documents. And so as I was going through them to try to piece together these stories when I was still, you know, back here in Winnipeg, I'm reading this affidavit from an undercover FBI agent that was used to secure a number of the arrest warrants. And all of a sudden, it's quite clear they're talking about me and that Patrick Matthews, while he was down in Georgia and was hanging out with other members of the base, plotting various things, he got onto the subject of me, at least according to this undercover FBI agent, claiming that, you know, I was essentially just an anti-fascist activist, not a journalist, and that what I had done should carry the death penalty.
What was your first thought when you read that?
It was pretty unnerving. Having said that, it was, I guess, somewhat expected. There's been blowback from my reporting on this story. Certainly some threats have come my way. And obviously, I was pretty sure that, you know, Mr. Matthews wasn't pleased with me and what I had done.
Right. And so maybe now I'll get you to kind of follow up on all the reporting you've done here. The last time we talked to you was right after you had outed Patrick Matthews as a white supremacist recruiting for a domestic terror organization, essentially. And then he vanished from Canada. What do we know about what happened right after you outed him?
Thanks to these court documents that have been coming out, we've really filled the gaps in terms of what Matthews was up to, who he was with, and how he moved around in the aftermath of him disappearing. So the FBI says that two members of the base drove more than 600 miles from Maryland into Michigan to pick up Patrick Matthews after he illegally crossed into the United States after we at the Winnipeg Free Press exposed him. At that point, they're moving around a lot. At times, at one point, they're holed up in a hotel in Maryland. At another point, they're living in an apartment in Delaware. At another period of time, they're down in Georgia at one of these paramilitary training events called hate camps. So they're certainly quite busy. While Matthews and one of his co-accused, Brian Lumley Jr., are living at this apartment in Newark, Delaware, they're alleged to have purchased a number of firearm parts and to have manufactured a fully automatic assault rifle. They're also alleged to have stockpiled more than 1,650 rounds of ammunition, to have got their hands on some body armor. And according to the FBI, that was, you know, tracking these people with really some of the most sophisticated counterterrorism techniques at their disposal, they were plotting a number of things. At one point, Matthews was involved with hatching a murder plot down in Georgia to be perpetrated against a married couple that they had identified as anti-fascist activists. And also, while in Delaware, Matthews and his co-accused, Mr. Lemley, are alleged to have repeatedly discussed various violent attacks that they could carry out at the pro-gun rights rally in Richmond, Virginia, that was held on the 20th.
How did the FBI end up infiltrating this gang?
Yeah, so they deployed a number of different strategies. They were accessing cellular location data, recording telephone conversations, you know, tapping into encrypted chat rooms. They were at times trailing these suspects in person. They did searches of various properties while no one was present. They installed audio and video surveillance. And down in Georgia, at least, we also know that at least one undercover FBI agent directly infiltrated the organization.
So he was there while they were plotting things around the Virginia rally earlier than that. What kinds of stuff did he see in person?
So the undercover FBI agent was privy and witness to plots for the murder plot in Georgia. So what the FBI agent learned was that Patrick Matthews and another alleged member of the base who was arrested in a separate incident had identified this anti-fascist couple and begun making plans to assassinate them, essentially. But the FBI agent says that within a month after Matthews goes back to Delaware, his co-conspirator begins to sour on him and says that he thinks Matthews is incompetent. If they carry out the crime with him, they'll effectively all get arrested. So they decide to exclude him from the plan. But that then posed a problem, because if they carried out the crime without him, he was aware of it and would be able to tie them to it. So a member of the base down in Georgia then comes to the conclusion that what we're going to have to do is we're going to have to murder Matthews, and then we can go on to carry out this double murder against this activist couple. So in this bizarre twist, Matthews now finds himself in the crosshair of this murder plot that he helped hatch.
How close do we know that they got to carrying out any of these things? I mean, we know that they were arrested before the rally where a lot of this stuff was planned. But all the things that they discuss, it doesn't seem like any of them were that close to coming to fruition.
Well, in terms of the Virginia rally, I mean, they did amass, you know, not only a fully automatic assault rifle, but also a sniper rifle. They had gotten a bunch of different materials that they planned to use. They had bags prepared, you know, knives, you know, body armor, all of these things. And then they were discussing, you know, various different attacks that they could do. At one point, Matthews was talking about, you know, quote, literally hunting people. Mr. Lemley had thrown out the possibility of, you know, we need to find a police officer who's isolated so we can assassinate them. They'd also discussed the possibility of opening up fire on this crowd from multiple angles. Now, clearly, the FBI was concerned enough about this situation and felt they were ramping up to something enough that they moved in a few days prior to the scheduled rally to place these people under arrest. In terms of the plot coming out of Georgia, that one was planned very meticulously in a very in-depth way over the course of several months. So it seemed, at least according to these you know, court documents, that they were indeed gearing up to perpetrate this double murder.
Do we have any idea from the documents, or even just from anything the FBI has put together, how connected this cell was to the wider network of the base and how tied together this organization actually is?
So it's definitely a decentralized organization that purposely tries to create, you know, these information silos. But according to the documents, there was a number of gatherings, two gatherings in Georgia and another one planned in a different state that didn't end up taking place over the course of Matthew's time as he was illegally in the U.S. At the one in Georgia, I believe there was about 12 members that arrived there. So this would be, you know, several cells that would be converging in one location in order to train together and to build camaraderie. And in addition to this, they're also communicating in these encrypted chat rooms in order to establish connections amongst themselves. So while it needs to be understood as a, you know, decentralized organization, and each individual cell has a fair amount of autonomy in terms of, you know, what they're going to carry out, it's definitely a loose connection. And certainly, as we saw with Matthews, it's a network that has the ability to ferry someone who's subject of multiple national security investigations in Canada, help him escape to the U.S., and then successfully move him around about four different U.S. states and provide him with safe harbor.
Do we have any idea what Matthew's standing is or was in the organization as a whole? When you met him, I guess he was a recruiter, but how was he regarded by the base in the United States in general?
Well, there's some indication that at least sections of the membership looked up to him due to his military background, and that he perhaps would have been trying to pass on some of his skills, to other members of the network. But it also seems like after his time in Georgia, at least with the one, you know, neo-Nazi comrade down there, who's an individual by the name of Mr. Lane, he certainly soured on him and eventually, you know, as I mentioned, came to the conclusion that Matthews was incompetent. You know, what his current standing might be in the eyes of his fellow, neo-Nazis in the base kind of remains unclear at this point.
Tell me about when the FBI finally decided to move and arrest these guys.
Yeah, they were taken into custody January 16th. Matthews and Lemley, my understanding is, were at their Delaware apartment. The FBI begins to move in on them. And as they realize that they're about to be busted, Matthews and Lemley are accused of smashing their cell phones and dumping them in the toilet in an attempt to destroy some evidence. Little did they know this was being captured on FBI surveillance video. One of the more disturbing things was that the FBI was able to get access to Matthews' personal computer. And on there, he had recorded a number of propaganda videos where he was effectively urging other neo-Nazis to engage in violent attacks in order to spark what he called a revolution for the white race. In one of these videos, Matthews is wearing a gas mask. So it's a very, you know, striking image. And he's doing this in order to try and conceal his identity. And one of the direct quotes that he says is, you know, something along the lines of, derail some effing trains, murder some people, poison some water supplies. You better be ready to do this. If you want the white race to survive, you're going to have to do your part.
Jeez.
Yeah, it was pretty unnerving stuff. But having said that, it fits with what we know about the base from my reporting and from the reporting from a couple other journalists that focus on this file, which is that this is an organization that is a proponent of terror.
Hi there, I'm Gavin Crawford. I'm a writer, an actor, and a comedian. And for the last 8 or 9 years, I have been navigating life with my mother's increasing dementia. Has it been sad? Yeah. Has it been funny? Also, yeah. That's what my brand new podcast series, Let's Not Be Kidding, is about. It's the true story of my life as a comedian, my mom, and dementia. Let's Not Be Kidding, with me, Gavin Crawford. A new 7-part series from CBC Podcasts, available now.
Do we have any idea? Because I know there's been some discussion about how seriously organizations like the FBI take white supremacist domestic terror and whether or not they're as active against it as they are against Islamic terror or other religious-based terror. Do we have any idea if this kind of signals a new step forward by the FBI to try to infiltrate and crack down on this, or do we just have no idea what they're doing?
Well, it certainly seems like that because, while Matthews was illegally in the U.S., they were subject to a very intense very long investigation. The FBI was throwing some serious resources towards this thing, investing a lot of time and effort, a lot of different agents deploying a lot of different techniques. And it wasn't just the FBI. We also know that the ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, was involved in this investigation. The DOJ from multiple states was involved in this investigation. So in my opinion, that certainly signals that, U.S. federal law enforcement recognizes neo-Nazi accelerationist groups as a serious threat and is responding accordingly.
You just got back from Maryland, where you attended Matthews, as well as one of the others' detention hearings?
That's correct.
What were those like? What happened there?
It was a pretty interesting experience. On Wednesday at 10:30 a.m., this would be Eastern time down in Maryland, Matthews was brought into U.S. federal court to have a detention hearing. One of the most kind of noteworthy moments came right off the beginning as Matthews is being led in. And what was striking to me was that, his Canadian Armed Forces uniform that we've seen him in so many pictures has been exchanged for, the orange jumpsuit of a U.S. federal prisoner. And as he's being led in by the bailiff, he's scanning the faces that are in the crowd. And then he appears to notice me. And immediately the look on his face changes and his eyes just narrow, and he starts just glaring at me hard. So that was a pretty intense moment, because this is the first time we've seen one another, in 5 months. There was another very unnerving moment that I think stuck out in the mind of a lot of reporters that were there. The judge in this case, Judge Timothy Sullivan, at one point was reading quotes from FBI surveillance, quotes from Matthews when he didn't know he was being recorded, where he is urging violence. And he's reading these into the court record. And at one point, he reads out the quote that I recounted to you about derailing trains and murdering people and poisoning water supplies. And as he is reading this, Matthews leans back in his chair and starts, pulling on his beard and begins laughing. So I think that was striking to a lot of people in the courtroom. The Matthews defense attorney ultimately argued that, these things that he said, which he conceded were odious and repugnant, as he put it, should be considered protected speech under the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, since they have, very broad and permissive speech codes in the U.S. The judge ultimately rejected this argument, saying that, Matthews' words might be considered protected speech, but they need to be contextualized within his alleged activity. So it wasn't just that he was saying these things, it was that he was allegedly taking concrete steps to carry out them as well. So the judge ultimately ruled that Matthews be detained in federal custody pending the unfolding of this court process, saying that he was a demonstrated flight risk and also a danger to the community.
What happens next? Do we have any dates, anything to plan for in terms of a trial?
So there's a preliminary hearing or preliminary trial coming up on January 30th, so very soon. Matthews will be back in court that day. His co-accused, William Bilbro, who's just 19 and who I attended his detention hearing Wednesday, he was also denied bail. He'll be back in court that day. And then their third accused, Mr. Lemley, will be expected back in court that day. But one thing that's noteworthy is that Lemley waived his right to a detention hearing. So he is consenting to remain in federal custody at this point. I've been told that's relatively rare, and what exactly it could signal kind of remains up in the air. But that's certainly something that'll be interesting to take note of moving forward.
As we talk, do you have any idea, or I guess do we have any idea, how many more Patrick Matthews there are in Canada? How active is the base up here compared to in the United States?
There's certainly smaller numbers up here than in the U.S. They're more active down there, and that is the country they were founded in. Back when I infiltrated this organization, there had been some evidence that there could be a recruitment drive in Saskatchewan, but I think that's gone relatively silent at this point. Whether or not there's still someone or, a cell there kind of remains unclear. I was also told that there was a cell operating on the East Coast that had at least a couple of members. In addition to this, the base has previously had a member in Quebec that was exposed, who I believe is now, his whereabouts are unknown. And after we exposed Matthews, the base finally came out and acknowledged its official cooperation with the Adam Waffen Division, which has long been considered its sister organization, in which the FBI says there's a fair amount of cross-pollination in terms of membership in the two groups. The Adam Waffen Division, like the base, represents the most violent extreme fringes of the far-right hate movement. They are responsible for numerous hate crimes and murders over the past 5 years. The Adam Waffen Division has, it's been shown that they've had members on the East Coast, they've had members in Ontario, they've had members on, I believe, in BC and perhaps even Alberta. So when you take a look at both of these organizations, we're not talking about a lot of people, but we are talking about activity in multiple Canadian provinces. And while it perhaps is reassuring that there aren't a lot of these people out there, I think it needs to be pointing out, and I've been stressing this throughout this entire, you know, unfolding case, is that it, you know, it only takes one lone actor. And it certainly doesn't take a whole lot of IQ points to pick up a gun and start shooting. So we shouldn't be kind of lulled into a false sense of security by the fact that this organization has been sloppy enough to allow some of its members to be arrested, or that they don't appear to have a massive membership.
Finally, are you concerned at all now that you're on the radar of this group in general, or did you get the sense that that was more of a personal vendetta from Mr. Matthews?
No, I think I am probably on the radar of the organization more generally. Before Matthews was arrested, the organization released a new propaganda video, which included a threat against me and a threat against some other reporters that cover this stuff. That's certainly not the only threat I've gotten. And when it comes to stuff, you kind of have to take it seriously. Mm-hmm. That is a concern. Safety is obviously, top of mind, and I'm going to continue to be cautious and take steps to remain as safe as I can. Having said that, at no point throughout any of this have I thought I was in any sort of immediate physical danger.
Well, that's good. And please do stay safe. And thanks for talking to us.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Ryan Thorpe of the Winnipeg Free Press. That was The Big Story. You want more, we're at thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can find us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. We'd love to hear what you think. We'd love to hear what you think we should cover and what we shouldn't. You can also tell us what you think via a rating in your podcast app of choice if it allows you to do so. We don't listen to one-star ratings, but we read every five-star review. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.